what I've promised you last time was to, or what I've indicated that would happen next would be the limitations of weight and log-free algorithms. So, so far what we have seen was quite nice properties for these log-free algorithms. You had no chance to create anything like a deadlock or something. However, there are severe downsides of the whole thing. For example, what you have to cope with is that the only way to get these log-free algorithms to work is by using some kind of single atomic operation. So you're kind of limited on what your current architecture is giving you to work with. So you might want to check the instruction manual of the architecture against which you program. And that we have seen something like that when we were using these assembly instructions with a log prefix. So that's what we are actually depending on. And also, there's not all of the instructions of such a processor that you can actually log with a prefix. So you have to check your instruction manual. And with that, you're quite limited to what you actually get on this architecture. Yeah. You thus only have a limited set of things that you can achieve. So the typical things are you can exchange a memory cell with a register. You can do these compare and swap type instructions. You can do these fetch and add type instructions. Also, you can do the modify and test. So these are typical idioms in log-free algorithms, and those are the ones that you find most often on these architectures. Okay. Also, that's probably also pretty clear. You cannot do that with a whole lot of data. You're in most cases limited to only one memory operand. So that's what you have to deal with in these situations. Well, with such properties, you're quite limited in what you can do. However, you can use them to create larger instructions, which you can use in a more abstract way. For example, you might have heard of things like semaphores. So these are the counting and the binary ones. You might have heard of mutexes or monitors. These are kind of more high-level instructions that you can realize with the means that you get with our log-free algorithms. And with that you can create more advanced algorithms. And that's what we're going to see on the next few slides. However, in the way that we use them, we will come to the next downside that we buy into by using these templates. Well, the general name of these types of instructions or data structures are logs. And that's because we can lock up our algorithms with them. So that's the next kind of category of our algorithms. And, well, what you should bear in mind is that, well, these are kind of the log-free instructions are kind of the building blocks for these logs. When you use these logs as high-level features, you will you will do nothing that you cannot achieve by using the low-level ones. However, if you're not interested in exactly the pattern that these more high-level data structures like logs provide, then you might also think about recoding something different with your log-free things. So there are quite interesting applications for these log-free algorithms in data structure development, and there's whole scientific papers on that, which are, well, the kind of the frontier of science at the moment. So, yeah, with that, there's still a possibility to earn yourself some credits. Anyway, let's proceed to the lock data structures or the lock instructions, locked atomic executions. Yeah, that's once again the reference for you. What can you do with locks? Locks are for a specific situation, for a specific pattern in which you want to protect a piece of code from interference with other threats. And you call that a critical section. So that's a piece of code that can be gravely disturbed by interference. So it might produce something inconsistent or incorrect when it is concurrently reached from several threads. What it helps in that case is that it gets you mutual exclusion, so that only either of the thread actually enters at one time, and the other threads are blocked as soon as they try to enter while one of the other threads is still in this critical section. And yeah, you have to kind of try to get your access by acquiring or releasing such a lock. However, as the name already says, we might end up in situations where we deadlock the program, which is something that we couldn't achieve before when we had these just lock-free algorithms. That's because we have certain a certain structure in our way that we implement them, but we'll see that, for example, here. So that's the first type of common programming pattern that we see here, which is a so-called semaphore. And essentially what the semaphore is, it is an integer, and it is associated with a certain type of operations. And once again, you'll see me use these atomic constructs, which are to be translated into the architecture-specific internals that vary from architecture to architecture. So you have to replace them with what actually happens on your machine. So, but anyway, from the more abstract point of view, what you want to do is you want to offer a way to express your interest in acquiring that special lock data structure. You do that with the wait operation, and as soon as you don't need to access that lock anymore, what you do is you signal for others so that they can enter the critical section now. So how do these things work in detail? Let's have a closer look into that. What you do is, well, first of all, you keep yourself the status, or you reserve some space for this, whether you are allowed to enter the critical section or not, with this availability flag, whether your critical section is available for you. Then you what you do is you go into an atomic instruction. So you do in one step check whether the integer that is associated with this lock is larger than zero. That is kind of encoding whether there's still room for you inside the critical section. And if so, if this lock is available for you, you will make the lock remember that you have already entered, so that you will decrease the counter of entering threats here in this point. Okay, so that's what you do in one go. If the integer is larger, is not larger than zero, but zero or even negative, then there's conceptually no place for you there's no room for you to enter into this critical section. In this case, what will happen is that the availability flag will remain false, and you won't keep count of you as entering in the integer, so you won't decrease the integer. And at that point, what you'll do is you will, now that you have left the atomic region, you can evaluate your locally available flag, which is also called available here. But in any way, you will be able to check your flag. Now it's exclusive to you because it's your local variable. And in case that it has been available, you can just leave the whole call to wait and proceed on with your critical section. In case that it was not available, you will go back to the beginning and try to achieve the or to get the lock for yourself. So in this case, you will then do what you wanted to do within your critical section, which would be something complicated. And in the end, what you do is you will release your lock with a signal to the others that might be waiting. And in this case, you're not competing with anyone for the critical section. So all you need to do is you need to consistently modify the semaphore counter. So what you do is you atomically, no, not like this. You atomically increase the associated integer for the semaphore. Okay. You want an example where what would be useful?
The value of S is higher than 1, say 3.
The benefits of count.
If you want binary exclusion, then of course you will start with a value for like 1. But if you, for example, have something like a queue or something where there or some kind of, yeah, if you have a buffer system where you have several several items to be given away to something, you can remove things from this buffer for as long as they are still items stored within the buffer. So you can start off your entrance lock for the removing part with something larger than 1, and each time that someone has taken out something, it will decrease the value until someone else puts some new item in, and then we'll enlarge the counter once again. Well, in the, I would say that if you, well, you would then once again have to use these atomic removals, which might be not so easily achieved. So, yeah, in that case, I would say it depends on the implementation, but. Yeah, it's not as easy as it seems.
Okay.
Okay. So, anyway, back to the whole thing. Yeah, that's the way that you want to use the semaphore. If you want to acquire your resource, you will execute wait. And in case that the semaphore counter is still large enough, then the wait will immediately return and let you pass through. And as soon as you're done with the whole thing, you will signal for the others waiting. That's the most common case that we know. It's a binary semaphore. And for that, we will just initialize with the counter of one. So this is something that can be used to predict a single source, and it's called mutex. Well, that's probably something that you already have known. One slight modification for the whole thing, because the way that you have seen it right now is the implementation that it's just the naive one that will go reevaluate whether the thing is available. You can do so, but when you do so, you will create something which is once again looping all the time until the condition is finally met. If that is, well, that is of course not producing any false results, but you might be wasting a lot of resources by just looping all the time through the whole system, as well as executing atomic instructions in each of these iterations. So that is something that you want to avoid. So the idea is now to introduce ways to not busily wait during your acquiring of the lock. And how's that done? Well, that's done by just interfering with the system in one line, specifically in the part where you have checked whether the lock is available for you. And at that point, if you have encountered that the lock is not available for you, you can just inform the scheduler that you are done at the moment, and the scheduler might consider to deschedule you for a certain amount of time. And then, once again, you can schedule when you are in control. You will reevaluate your lock condition. Because an optimized scheduling algorithm might want to monitor the locking variable, and as soon as there's a change on this variable happening, it might decide that now
the
what's with priorities? No. You need to keep in mind that you're not giving S itself, but you're giving its address. So as soon as the address of the variable occurs somewhere on the bus at some point, you can kind of get a callback there into the scheduler, and if that is registered for, well, if you have registered some callback, for example, for that address, then you can trigger that this thread will be scheduled once again as ready. So that would be an implementation. But it's highly dependent on what you can actually do on your architecture and how your operating system manages scheduling and all that. But an intelligent scheduler would, or a scheduler which is aware of the existence of these semaphores, would support something like whenever there's a change on a certain address, then reconsider whether some thread is still needs to wait. Yeah, so that's for at home, I think, and yeah, this also mentions this particular parameter to the descheduling. So operating systems might want to monitor these addresses for changes. Okay, so what the operating system does, that's, I think, all that we have already said. Also, there's still room for optimizations in that scheme. There's implementations where you, for example, don't really immediately deschedule because you heuristically have found that most of your semaphores are only held for very short times, and it might be too much of an overhead to actually deschedule your thread. Instead, it might be reasonable to remain in control for a few cycles and let the waiting thread perform a few active rounds of spin locking before actually going to sleep and descheduling. You still are okay. Good. So that would be one of the optimizations that you can do, and that's mainly for semaphores that are expected to be held for a short time. Okay. And the other thing is what we've seen so far is a very concise implementation of the signal. And as we have already talked about this, about the scheduling, and that scheduling might support changes to certain variables. Well, this might at some point also need help from the signal, from signaling functions, so that at that point there might be some call to the scheduler that we have now actually changed our value of the semaphore variable so that we can reschedule one of the waiting processes. Once again, so that might be occurring in the signal code. Yeah. The other thing is that in case that you just do your semaphore with a single thread, the whole system will collapse into just this sequence of increases and decreases, or decreases and increases here. And you might consider when programming that semaphores are not so much of a bother if you just have a single thread and you can program in a way that it might be safe in cases where you have several threads there. But yeah, I think that's more a matter of programming style. So, for example, what how can we make use of our newly introduced programming pattern? Let's think about trying to parallelize existing code, like that queue implementation here that we would like to make thread safe. So, what we have here is a double-ended queue, which has for both of the ends, some terminating sentinels. So there's the left sentinel and the right sentinel. And what for such a data structure, we would need certain things to be consistent, like that the these things are always pointing in a consistent way to each other. So that each time if you navigate right from the left sentinel and navigate left again, you will once again reach your left sentinel. So you will need consistent values within your pointers. So that's something that sounds like that modifications to such lists need to be mutually exclusive. So that would be probably a good idea to try our new features out. So let's have a look at how that is implemented, for example. So let's look at the case where we want to add a certain element to our double-ended queue. That's something that we want to achieve with this push left. We get as parameter our kind of anchoring data structure, which is this DQ thing, which corresponds to kind of that object here, and a new value that we want to insert at the very left. So we want to enter some new box over here. For that, we need to change a little bit in the internals of the whole thing. So let's have a look at what we need to do. Well, first of all, we create a new, well, that's probably better in red, a new node for, no? Red and this. A new node for our element where we can assign our element to. And then what we need to do is we need to prepend that newly created node in our list. And for that, we need to obtain the left sentinel by reading from the queue's left attribute. Then we save the old left node, which is, well, probably just this 10 in that case, which is which you can obtain by following the right reference here. And now what we need to do is we need to insert our new red thing, our newly created node. We do so by setting the left and right for these things accordingly. So we will connect our new element to the left sentinel and to the old left node. And then we need to manipulate the other peers, like the left sentinel. So left sentinel is right. That's this one here. Probably with blue because that will be visible better. And also old left left reference. So these are the things that need to be manipulated. And only after we have touched the left attribute of the old left node, we are in a consistent state once again. So when does the inconsistency of our list actually start? Well, that's well, it's probably over here somewhere where we do, where we obtain our old left node. That needs to be one transaction over here. Probably also we need to, well, we'll see. So that is kind of the area that we need to protect from others while we are working on the list. So that is the place where our new constructs can shine, because they are there for guaranteeing mutual exclusion. So what we will create there is the binary semaphore, because, well, that's the way to only let one thread at one point into one critical section. So for that, we need to add a lock to the double-ended queue data structure. And we need to decide what to protect or not. That's what we have. That's what we have seen on the last slide. So we now add our code for the mutexes. We have seen how wait and signal are implemented already in the last few slides. So we now introduce the wait on our newly created semaphore here in order to enter the critical section, and also we introduce the signal also on the same thing in order to make sure that we let someone else enter our critical section. And in between, we perform all of the things that we said that would be needed to be exclusively done. So that was that part over here. Okay. It can get more confusing than that by if you have more complicated situations, for example, the removal. To make things a little bit shorter than before, we don't need to parse the whole thing. You can do so at home. Apart from having the manipulations on our common data structure protected with the signal only, we need to make sure to really get all the points where we actually leave that part of code, and it's not only. It's not always just sequences of code that we want to protect from concurrent accesses, but there might be also control structures within. For example, here we have an if with a return over there. That's what typically the removal would need to do in case that there's nothing inside the queue. We would return early with a kind of error message. But if we just protect the beginning and the end of our code sequence like we have so far, we might miss a point, specifically this return over here, which, well, is a little bit hidden inside, and for that we would also need to leave our mutex with a signal. So what we get from that is that in case that we get more complicated code, semaphores are something that are quite easy to get wrong. So we need to be careful in that case. The general concept that we can derive from that is that we take the lock just when entering the code and release on the exit, and just make sure that we get all the exits. So, for example, this return here is an early exit. Also, we might have to think of something like exception handling, which turns the whole thing even more complicated, because in these cases also we might need to release some lock or something. So, yeah, it's not always as easy as in the first example. Yeah, even more, code or algorithms are entities that are not always just written in an intra-procedural style. So you not all the time write your algorithms just down in one sequence, probably with some variations in there with if then else or just with a single loop. But you might also want to issue calls to other functions that might be useful for you. And in these cases, you might also want to call other functions that touch the same data structure. So for some more complicated features on the double ended list, you might want to make use of earlier, more simple utility functions you have already provided. And if you just have your locks acquired at the entry of your procedure and released at the end, you will run into problems as soon as you call your other utility method from inside there, because at the very beginning of the utilities functions code, you will also have an acquirer of the lock. So, because you already have acquired that lock beforehand, this lock will stay locked also for your recursively called other utility function, and this will block. So that is something which is tackled by another type of lock, which is the monitor. A monitor is a reentrant mutex. With that, you can make your code thread safe in the sense that with the mutex you can enter the mutex as one thread, and whichever call you do from within that that code, when it tries to enter the mutex once again, it will not block but let you through, and just internally keeps count of how many times you have tried to enter the mutex, and makes sure that only after the last release or signal of your mutex, you will release the whole lock and give the chance to someone else to enter the critical section. So, the reoccurring pattern that we have seen beforehand was that we would like to guard our code with a lock at the beginning and a release at the end. But in order to allow for recursive calls, you need to support that if you come from the same thread, you still are allowed to enter. That's, I think, for at home. So how would you do implementation of your monitor? Well, for once, the monitor contains a mutex and as well as information about the thread that is currently occupying that monitor. So for that, you would need the monitor to be a struct, for example, with two flags, with two fields, for one the thread ID and for the other the count, in which you take you count how many times you have entered the monitor, and you would initialize the whole thing appropriately with some initialization, like the monitor init. Once again, that's just kind of abstract code. It depends on the actual library or the actual environment or system that you use for programming your monitors. So that might change a little bit, but in general, the principles should be similar to the things that you see here. So let's define the two coding methods that we need to support this this pattern of at the beginning entering a monitor and the end leave. So we will need two functions, monitor enter and monitor leave. And what we need to achieve here is mutual exclusion of accesses to the monitor type. And we need to track how many times we have called the enter on the monitor in order to decide when we have actually left the whole monitor. So we need these two pairs of methods. Let's have a look at how we can achieve that. Well, once again, we need atomic access here within a while loop where we want to check whether the monitor's thread ID is actually our own thread ID. Because if it is ours, then we need to just increase the counter. And in case it is not ours, well, then we need to, in this case, we will check whether the thread ID of the monitor is actually zero. That is the value that we would use in case that the monitor is not in use by anyone else. So if that is the case, we can switch then to mine. So we will see that we will set our local variable to signal that the monitor is actually ours. We will initialize the count of the monitor with one so that it is actually in use. And also at the same time we need to save the thread ID of ourselves into the monitor's data structure. So if we've done so, we are ready to rock our monitor, and we can just leave the monitor enter. And in case that the monitor was not actually successfully obtained by me, but is in use by someone else, that's this situation here. We can once again deschedule, and due to space reason, that's a little bit it's not so obvious. We will just return to the beginning of the while and restart our whole transaction like this. So you see, in order to implement our basic monitor, we will have quite a large scale basic monitor, a large scale atomic fraction here. So I have not actually tried to find a sequence of a sequence of basic instructions that would encode that. Maybe the way to do that would be to just resort to a simple mutex to keep that thing.
Can you explain why do you need to keep track of the number of times you enter the monitor?
Because you will at some point call this monitor leave once again, and for that you need to decide when to release ownership of the monitor by setting the thread ID of the monitor to zero. Because at some point, you have to keep in mind that the situation is that there are several threads competing for this monitored critical section, and that the first one that has entered this critical section, who has ownership on the monitor, is allowed to re-enter and re-enter and re-enter as long as it wishes. And each time in its cascade of enterings, it will at one point call leave, and this leave must decide whether it now lets someone else has ownership for. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why you keep count. Okay. Good. So now we've also shed a little bit light into the monitor leave. Well, for that, yeah, what we've said is that we will decrease the our counter of how many enters we have passed so far. And if we have reached zero, then we will release the ownership for the monitor and leave our monitor and let someone else enter the whole thing. Okay. So with the for our example, the queues, once again, we can apply our monitors now in order to make more complicated transactions or to make it possible to use more complicated transactions. We would, for our case, instrument our push left with monitor enter and monitor leave, for example, also keeping in mind that somewhere inside there will be some if with a return, where we also need to put our monitor leave in there. Anyway, but that's all within these few dots. Yeah, but the thing that is important here is that now with our monitor instead of the plain semaphore, what we can do now is we can also create something like a for all, which would get a callback method as parameter, which then can be used within the for all to be applied to each of the elements within the queue. That's something that might come in handy. However, people might want to call, for example, push left during the run through all of our queue elements. So we might have ended up when we would only have our semaphore with something that locks. But in our case, now that we have switched over to monitors, we can protect I'll run through the queue here with our monitor enter and monitor leave, and use in our callback, whichever that might be, also a push left, and don't create a deadlock with that. Yeah, it remains to be seen whether that. That leads to problems once again, because you're within one of these runs and might and changing something to the elements while you are still within the run might also lead to problems. But at least you don't have a deadlock here anymore. But yeah, of course, it might be that such a mutual exclusion might have been there for a reason. So yeah, that's just it's not about the meaningfulness of the whole example, but more on the expressiveness, what you can do now. So if you have some complicated transaction that can be built from several building elements, then you can do so now with such a monitor, but you need to make sure that now the whole thing still internally keeps track of consistency of its data. So yeah, that's what you don't get automatically by that. Okay, so in any way, what the monitor instead of the mutex ensures is that you can recursively call and do not block. Next thing would be condition variables. Well, what is a condition variable? Well, the what you get with the monitor is that you can have several reentrant can have reentrant code within the same thread which does not block. That's one of the features which is quite nice. The other one would be to tackle another problem, because if you want to use a certain resource for synchronization, you might run into a certain problem. For example, if you start with a thread T that waits for a data structure to be filled. Well, for example, with a queue from before, it will, for example, do so by calling pop write. However, if it is written in the way that we've seen before, the whole system will just terminate the call that you the call to pop write and just return a minus one, and you're there at the same situation once again as the one who wants to wait for an element in this queue, and you have to call again until at some point the element is available. Of course, that's something that's once again busy waiting, and that will create a lot of traffic on the lock, and that's something which is clearly not desirable, because, well, as we'll see tomorrow in the tutorial, that is quite expensive. So our idea around that is to extend our monitor another concept, which is the condition variable, on which we can block while we wait for the monitor. So we add another condition variable in our data structure. Yeah, now we have the functions wait and signal, and now that we have this condition variable, what should they do? Well, the wait is something which would have to be called while we are within the bounds of the monitor. So that would be while we have entered, before we have left the monitor. And this would temporarily release all of the monitor and blocks its execution. And it would continue only when it once again gets signaled by someone else. And in that case, it would reacquire the monitor and return execution. Of course, now that we've talked about this wait method, we have also mentioned the signal. And signal is the way to it's exactly the peer. It is used to indicate to the waiting partners of our system to resume working. So what's that? guess. Okay, so when a signal happens, one or all the waiting threads, which are the threads that have actually called wait, will be woken up. There are several possibilities, several strategies in practical systems how this is actually handled. There's the concept of signal and urgent wait. In this case, you always have to imagine that there's several places for waiting. There's threads that are waiting to enter the monitor from outside, and there's also threads that have been doing something within the monitor and have been suspended because they have explicitly chosen to call wait. And the signal and urgent wait treats those two groups of threads differently. In the urgent wait approach, the threads that have called the wait are actually preferred to the ones that are coming from outside and try to newly enter the monitor. With the signal and continue strategy, what we get is that the entering and the signaled threads that came from the waiting call are actually put into the same class and treated with the same priority when reacquiring the logs, so that there might be situations where the threads that re-enter our monitor are actually preferred to the ones that have issued the wait from inside. That's probably something that needs a little bit more explanations. So let's have a look at signal and urgent wait semantics with diagrams here. So you see the situations for signal and urgent wait semantics here. There's first the two pairs of actions, this enter and leave, which are the enter and leave for the whole monitor. The enter has before a thread actually is allowed inside the critical section, which would be this room here. It has to queue up as long as there is one member, one other thread inside the critical section. So there's an entry queue. As soon as the entered thread issues a wait, it will be transferred into another queue, which is the wait queue, and it depends on how many condition variables you have actually added. This will determine how many of these queues actually are there. Well, for our purposes, let's just have a look at the AQ over there and ignore the BQ. If we transfer the thread from the critical section into the waiting queue for the condition variable, then we can have another thread enter the critical section, and in case that this one, for example, then issues a call to Well, that was another thing now. Issues a call to signal, then the thread that has done the issue itself will be put into the signaled queue, and we will immediately have one of the waiting ones extract into our critical section. And as soon as it leaves, we then will extract one of the waiting threads in the signaled queue. So the thing is that the signaled queue and as well as the condition variables queue have, in this case, priority over the newly entering threads from over here. So there's a lot of queues involved there. There's an entering queue, there's a signal queue, and there's a queue for each of the condition variables. And all the time we only have one thread within the critical section. When we assume the other semantics, the signal and continuous semantics, we will have a different setup here. We will have only one queue of threads that are queuing up for entering the critical section here. And in this case, the semantics is like this. The first thread that comes from over here is able to enter the critical section. As soon as it waits, it is transferred into the particular waiting queue for that conditional variable. And next one is taken from the enter queue, which is then somewhere else over here. And this might issue a notify. The notify at that point will, instead of taking the issuing thread to sleep and putting someone else into the critical section, will the notify in this case will just lead to the thread that belongs to the notified condition variable be transferred into the queue that that waits for entering in the critical section. And at some point, only when the particular thread decides to leave the critical section, only then we will consider to take someone else from the entering queue. And in this case, well, just everyone queues up for entering the critical section. So in this case, we might have threads from condition variable A, from condition variable B, or even from just the start of the monitor, competing for entering the critical section. And yeah, depends of course on the implementation of the data structure here, which of the threads are actually the ones that are prioritized. But well, if it happens to be just a queue, then if someone enters here before the notify has been issued, then we will have the waiting threads being put to the end of the queue and just have to wait for newly entering threads. Okay, so these are the two concepts of how we can realize our signal and notify as signal and wait pairs. And for this signal and continuous semantics, the signal function is often something that we call notify. And I think people who have had their introductory courses with something like Java will probably know these pairs of wait and notify. Anyway, the signal and continuous semantics are the ones that are most spread over all the all the programming languages. So these are the ones that we now focus on how we could realize them. Also, the signal and urgent wait variant is a lot more complicated to implement with all these different cues to watch, and yeah, it's just a mess to implement. So let's have a look at how the signal and continuous semantics actually are implemented. So we need once again two peers here. It's the wait for the conditional variable and the notify. And the notify, well, that's just issuing a signal to our condition variable. What that does is actually then depending on the implementation of the conditioned wait. For the signal and continue, we don't need to do something like moving into the special queue for the signalers. So we can just ignore that and terminate our notify here. So that's quite nice to implement. The wait. Let's have a look at what the wait actually does. So wait is something that you issue when you already have entered the monitor and realize that now is not the, the time to do our action, and we want to wait for a certain condition. So in this case, what we can assume is that the monitor that we're doing the wait on already is in possession of our thread. So we possess the monitor already. So that's why the thread ID should be the same as our own thread ID. Yeah, and now that we want to wait here, we will temporarily release possession of our monitor. So that's why we have to save the current counter of our monitor. So we put it into our old count variable. Then we will put a zero into our thread ID in order to make it possible for other threads to enter our critical section. And then we just do a plain wait as we have seen on the slides before. So we will deschedule in this case. So the point where we will be resuming our work is when someone else has given out a notify and the signal. So the signal will terminate our wait that we have here. So these two are collaborating in this case. So now we're in control again, and now everything that's assumed from condition wait is that we now compete for the monitor once again. So for that, we need our usual code for competing on monitors. That's by declaring our flag and perform our atomic operations on the relevant monitor data. So that's this thing here, where we check whether the thread ID is zero, so that nobody's in possession of the monitor at the point, and if nobody is in possession, well, if this evaluates to true, then we can take possession of the monitor by putting our thread ID into the monitor and restoring the counter to the value that it had before. And In every other case, we will have to deschedule with that and at some point re-enter the loop. In every other case where we have successfully competed for the monitor, we will exit and continue our work. So that's how we can build up our condition variables in the monitor with the help of the signal weight mechanisms. Okay. Good. So for implementation purposes, there's different notions of the notification functions in the signal and continue semantics. There's notify, which just extracts one thread that's waiting on the condition variable, and there's possibility for notify all. For just extracting just one waiting thread, we have to manage a queue and determine one specific thread to wake up. In some configurations, that is something which is quite costly, and it becomes a lot easier to implement if we can declare that our notify will, although not notifying everyone in our waiting queue, will not notify just particularly one thread but a few others. So a few of the implementations out there will not guarantee that you're the only one who awakens when wait terminates. So that's something programmers should keep in mind. Good. About priorities of the notified threads, well, that is of course depending on how the OS actually handles the different competitors for the monitor. And for example, if it is FIFO order, then notified threads will run after threads that have entered or have tried to enter the monitor since the wait has been called. But yeah, that's highly dependent on the OS implementation and how. And if you are in some kind of runtime, of course, then it's depending on how complex the implementation for the whole scheduling of competitors for monitors is actually implemented. So, for our purposes, we can try to implement this pop-write with monitors and condition variables. And for that case, we would once again have a look at our pop-write, where we had already added the monitor enter and the monitor leave. And now we can, instead of just returning minus one, which we had done before when our queue was not filled yet. Instead, we can now that when we see that the right sentinel and the left sentinel are the only two things that I have in grasp in my double linked list, then I can issue a wait on the condition variable, and in case that I awaken once again, I can do my beloved go-to to re-evaluate the actual status of my list in order to get to know whether I'm still an empty list or whether there has been something added for me in my doubly linked list. So that would be what I'm able to express with my monitors added by condition variables. Yeah. Okay. So if we compare monitors to semaphores, well, from an expressional point of view, well, both of these things are, of course, made up from the same components in the very bottom. And we can try to simulate one with each other. For example, we can what we can do is we can implement a monitor with semaphores by protecting each of the queues just with a mutex. If you remember this model of the internal workings of the monitor, we have several queues in there, and if we protect each of them with a mutex, we can in the end achieve something similar as the monitor. And the semaphore for then can be implemented using a monitor. Well, by what we'll do is we will just protect the semaphore variable with the monitor itself, and the weight can be just implemented with the condition weight, so that's not so difficult to do. So I think we will detail more on that in the tutorial. Okay. The way that you have probably seen monitors and condition variables implemented, that's what I have already asked, was probably with Java or C# or something, which are these high-level languages, and they have monitors coupled with a single condition variable and built into the language. So what you get there is this tiny little keyword synchronized, which is added as modifier to your method, which is doing something similar as just the monitor enter and monitor leave. And what you can then do is you can issue a wait and a notify in the code within there. So yeah, that's roughly what the monitors in Java can do, and the wait and the notify are just referring to this. Well, the synchronize is kind of coupled to the object which is created at some time from this class template C, and the wait and the notify are coupled to exactly the same object identity. So you can have several of these monitor condition variable pairs out there, but they identify themselves by the object address of the object that you call the monitor on, or the wait or the notify on. And yeah, conceptually each of these objects that are created from a class have in them one of these queues for their internal condition variable, and you can fill them with a wait that you execute on one of these objects, and you can empty them by notifying on these objects. In order to do so, you need to be inside the critical section for this monitor, which is then which is automatically done by writing the synchronized in the list of modifiers there, and then the whole area within the body of the function would then correspond to the critical section for the monitor for this object. You can also explicitly do so by, I think it's just saying synchronized and then taking the object there. So synchronized O would then open a monitor area for that object. So that's a way to include condition variables and monitors into languages. Okay, so I think for deadlocks it's a little bit not enough time today, so I would say we stop here and continue next time.